with a hearing on Senate Bill 881. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 881. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just be 1 second.
I like to keep them running around here. Can't let them get complacent. Sorry. I didn't think about that when I opened it up.
My large stack of bills.
Did you find it?
I did.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 881 is a bill that would prescribe an instructional program to be established by the State Court Administrator's Office for court-appointed trustees. The bill would require court-appointed trustees to obtain annual hours of education with respect to their duties as trustees. It would also require trustees to obtain an annual audit and review of the trustees' fiscal affairs. The measure declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. There is an anticipated amendment, which we do not have yet in LC form, that would require the creation of a statewide registry of court-appointed trustees.
Thank you. And we have Representative Mona Sanderson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
Madam. Senator Mona Sanderson.
That's all right.
Many years
I made the same mistake. thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to present Senate Bill 881. This actually arose from a constituent that I have in Troutdale, and he is an investment planner, and he was citing a case of a man that was disabled, totally disabled, wheelchair bound, and his cognitive skills weren't very good. And his aunt, who had been caring for him, died, and he was left in an estate of almost $1 million. And in order for his affairs to be conducted, the court appointed a trustee, but the trustee really had no background, and so three attorneys got involved. One attorney and then another and then another. So there were three attorneys draining the assets that this disabled man had. So we were trying to brainstorm what could the state do to help a person like this, because the case manager that this person had couldn't really get involved. And so my staff pursued this, and I'd like my legislative staff to describe what, after some negotiation, what we could maybe possibly consider at the state level.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Michelle. Please introduce yourself
for
the record.
Did I introduce myself? I'm State Senator Lori Morris Sanderson.
You absolutely did after I blew it. Thank you.
State Senator.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Rosslow, and I am the legislative aide for Senator Lori Morris Sanderson. I know who she is. In order to address the issue of trustees and their obligations to their trust, Senator Mona Sanderson introduced Senate Bill 881. 881 was the very first draft of our concept, and since the bill has been written, we've developed a new set of ideas and amendments, which are being drafted in legislative council probably as we speak. The new amendment would put in place a statewide registry of conservators, guardians, and trustees. This amendment is modeled after legislation that's currently in California. And through this statewide registry, judges will access centralized information about the trustees, including their performance in multiple counties. The California law specifies that all the information in the registry is confidential except for their name, the fact that they're he or she is registered, and their education and professional experience. The registry will be maintained by the DOJ, and there are exceptions for these trustees. For example, people that serve less than three trusts, family members, or a combination of the two. The goal is that judges and the public will have access to the complaint information regarding the trustees when the court makes a finding that any of these trustees has not properly performed their duties. So we appreciate the time to talk about this now, and we hope that we can have further conversation once these amendments are drafted. And I also brought these. I forgot to turn them in so I can pass you back.
Thank you very much. This sounds like a worthy project you've undertaken. I appreciate you coming to tell us about it.
Great.
Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Wingo.
I'm sorry I didn't follow everything about your discussion with the amendments, so I apologize for that. Is the follow-up instruction of 16 hours, is that only going to be required while the person is still appointed as trustee?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, do you mean it within the bill?
Yeah, the intention is if they're no longer trustee, they no longer need the training.
Right, and actually how we had modeled the new amendment is to completely take out this whole education level component of it and the auditing system within that, because we want to start at a level and then see if the registry will contribute to helping solve some of these issues. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, well, we'll wait for the amendment and look forward to seeing it.
All right.
Thank you very much. Close
the
hearing on Senate Bill 881. Excuse me? Senator Przanski, for the first time in the history of the Judiciary Committee, would like to do a courtesy.
Just a recognition. I have a group of students that are here, Madam Chair, from Eugene, both Churchill High School and South Eugene High School. They're here advocating for the school-based health care programs. I asked them to come in and sit in and see how the legislative process works within the committee, so thank you very much for taking time out of your day to be up here and advocating for what you believe in. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, and I would like to add my voice in welcome. It's always wonderful to see students watching this process, so we very much welcome you here. Before I go to the next hearing, we will. I just want to announce that we are moving Senate Bill 966 to next Monday's agenda, and we will move Senate Bill 844 to next Wednesday's agenda. It still needs a little work on the amendments. So with that, I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 297. And we have Senator Brown and Senator Johnston who would like to come. So, Council, maybe you could... What? Oh, excuse me. I apologize. I misspoke myself. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 965, not 297.
Thanks, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate Bills 965 and 267 deal with basically the same issue, only different approaches. They're basically classic examples of the issues we face today in terms of technology, and that is the challenges of trying to keep current with the technological advances that are being made every day. With the advent of advanced technology, including recording devices and cell phone cameras, it's extremely important that we enact legislation to protect individuals from being photographed and privacy being invaded without their consent. Senate Bill 965 creates a civil cause of action, and Senate Bill 297, introduced by Senator Floyd Przanski, creates a crime. Basically, these deal with basically three issues: upskirting, video voyeurism, and cyber stalking. They extend current law to cover these instances. If adopted with the amendment, Senate Bill 965 will deal with the issue raised in the last 2 weeks regarding unwanted dissemination of photographs. If Ms. Barnes is not present, we do have a videotape showing what happened to her. You're going to hear from district attorneys who struggled to prosecute and individuals who've been affected by this behavior. I am confident that the stories you hear will want you to enact legislation immediately. I'm extremely concerned that our current laws don't meet the needs of Oregonians, and I urge your support. So, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from Senate District 16. I join with my colleague and friend, Senator Brown, in bringing these important pieces of legislation to your attention. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, and so I would like to share with you an example of a constituent issue that brought the subject matter of these important bills to my attention. You will hear further from excuse me, Clatsop County DA Josh Marquis, who will explain an issue that happened in Astoria. Young women at an aquatic center, part of a swim team, photographed with the use of one of these lenses that effectively strips away the veil of clothing.
Oh.
And again, this is available over the internet. It's a very modestly priced lens. It's less than $100 and has the net effect of rendering the subject matter of the picture in a state of undress not expected by the person being photographed. And so I share those pictures with you. They arise from a real fact scenario that occurred in Clatsop County, and I commend these two pieces of legislation to your serious consideration. I hope for the benefit of people who are the unwitting victims of the kind of behavior that these bills address, that you will act favorably on the legislation and move it forward in the process. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I did want to add for the record my name. I believe we forgot to do that. It's Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21. I did want to point out that the reason the basis of Senate Bill 965 and the Dash 1 and 2 amendments are here is through the media, that we learned of these circumstances about what was happening to Oregonians through the media, and I just want to thank them. And I also, for the record, Ms. Barnes will be here in about 10 minutes, and I think you should hear from her before you take action on either of these bills.
We will certainly do that, and I appreciate your coming. This has actually been an issue in my district as well, and I think this is a very sensible at a time of tight budgets where we don't have a lot of resources to deal with these criminal areas. I think this is a very common sense approach to make them pay if they do this sort of thing.
Madam Chair, do you wish we have a video available that brought the issue of cyber stalking. I actually viewed it in my office a couple weeks ago and created the amendments as a result of my viewing the video. If the committee wishes to see it, we have it.
We have students in the audience, so I've not seen it, so I don't know whether that would be appropriate.
I think it played on the news. So
play on channel 8. Oh, if it played on channel 8, then
okay.
I
can go.
Four-star rating.
Let's see the video. And why don't you turn around if it is acceptable for everyone? Maybe just rotate the screen a little bit so the audience members can see it as well. Not quite that much there. And let's see. How is that back there, audience? Okay.
They're like, now they want to see the video, Madam Chair.
Now that I've gotten your undivided attention.
I'm Joe Donald, of course, at 6, a unit investigation on a romance that turned sour, then pornographic. This horrible woman says her ex put explicit photos of her on the internet. And it gets worse. News Channel's Pat Morris is here with a story you'll see only on Impact. Cecilia Barnes feels she's being stalked by a former boyfriend over the internet. We talked with prosecutors and police and waited 2 months for them to take action. No one seems to be able to do anything about it. Cecilia Barnes works in a nondescript office in Southeast Portland. 4 years ago, she met a Beaverton man through the internet.
Is Randy Russell?
Randy Russell. 50 years old, an electrician who does odd jobs. Cecilia says the romance bloomed. They lived together in the Beaverton area duplex. At first, Cecilia says the relationship was good, but last winter, she says, he became abusive. She packed up and moved out. That's what she says. The terror began.
He sent me a card at Christmas time. Then he says, well, how do you like my new screen name? So he had the screen name there, and I went and I checked. And that's when I saw all the pictures.
The screen name led to an online site, Yahoo, and all the pictures. Rows and rows of pictures. Explicit, sexual. Cecilia and the ex-boyfriend. Cecilia alone.
I was like, oh my God. I can't believe that, you know. He's a sick man.
Cecilia says the ex-boyfriend created at least 3 profiles using her name on Yahoo. And each profile has her real name, her real workplace. And linked to those profiles were sexually explicit photographs. The hobbies listed for each profile include a variety of sexual activities that are suggestive but false and disgusting to Cecilia. Cecilia says she's written 4 times to Yahoo, trying to get them to shut down the sites.
But until early this week, they all still existed. They're for millions and billions of Yahoo members to see.
There's got to be something that I can do to, you know, permanently stop this. I just don't know what.
Tuesday, after calls from News Channel 8, Yahoo shut down two of the three offensive profiles. But Wednesday, one of them was back up again. And as horrified as Cecilia is about the pictures on Yahoo, it actually gets worse.
My ex-boyfriend has been online posing as me and setting up these dates for me.
That's right. Cecilia says Randy Russell, the ex-boyfriend, has posed as her in various internet chat rooms and invited men over to her workplace.
They're really expecting some kind of afternoon rendezvous, you know, some kind of sex-type date.
For the last 2 months, she says 12 men showed up at work, the most recent just last Thursday. Julie Jeffers is Cecilia's boss. She was there when one of the men came in.
And he walked in the door and said, Cecilia, and he was very excited and was just Cecilia out because he'd seen the pictures. And he said, and you and I talked last night. She said, no, I most certainly did not talk to you. And he just about backed right out without looking right or left. He backed right back out the door and I'm sorry, and off he went.
Jeffers says she went and confronted Randy Russell on the phone, and then he laughed it off.
He just basically laughed and claimed that he didn't know what I was talking about and said, you know, well, I'm not doing it myself. But then that's when it started increasing then the very next day.
More calls to the office. More men stopping by for sex dates. Why can't police put a stop to it? Believe it or not, what Cecilia says the ex-boyfriend did may have been a loophole in Oregon law, which is not kept up with technology. A Multnomah County judge told Cecilia she was not being stopped unless the ex-boyfriend contacted her directly. And it appears privacy laws designed to keep cameras out of porta-potties and tanning beds cannot be used to keep those nude pictures of Cecilia off the internet.
In these cases like this, clearly, I think the public would say that there's outrage. Normally, this should not happen to anyone. But it's different for me to sit here and say this shouldn't ever happen to anyone than to be able to, you know, have the next day, well, and arrest somebody and then put them in jail because it happened.
All of it leaves Cecilia Barnes feeling vulnerable and very afraid.
Yeah, I do. I feel personally endangered. And when I leave every day from work here, I look around, and when I drive off, I make sure nobody is following me. I mean, I don't feel safe at all.
We tried to contact Randy Russell multiple times, calling his phone number and going to his home. Still not heard back from him. Also, Yahoo says its abuse team is investigating Cecilia's complaints about those profiles and pictures. A spokeswoman says Yahoo has a strong track record of aggressively investigating such allegations and could remove the offensive material or deactivate the account. Joe, Pat, thank you. Melissa, the last question.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful video. I just wanted to take this opportunity to kind of remind the students in this and sort of educate the students who are here today that this is really a good example of how we work in the legislature, how a bill becomes law. This is an area where the law, you heard him say it, has not kept up with the technology. Anyone, any common sense person can tell that this is wrong. And but the law has not caught up with the technology to actually make this illegal. And if something is not illegal in the law, then you can't take action against people. And it also shows the influence of the media in our process, because this was a situation where there was a real problem there, and the media saw this as news. And of course, legislators, I had not seen this myself, and I think some of my colleagues hadn't either, but the media helps to elevate issues like this that are of great concern. And that's why the legislature meets every 2 years, is because our job is to continually keep the law up to date with what's going on out there in the real world. There are crimes that we have on our books today that could not even have been conceived of 25 years ago, 50 years ago. So thank you, Senator Brown, for passing this note and reminding me to point that out.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I would just add that while my constituents, young high school women, did not make the news. It is no less egregious that they should be observed through their bathing suits in a public facility in such a way as to reveal their most intimate personal body details. And they didn't make the news, but it is no less egregious, no less harmful to them, and no less repugnant, demanding, I think, action from the legislature.
I appreciate that, and as a mother of a teenage daughter, I doubly appreciate that. So I appreciate you both coming. And do you know when Ms. Barnes is she here yet?
I don't see her, but I believe folks are watching for her, and we'll let you know.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add that I really appreciate the help of committee counsel. When Mr. Doris brought this to my attention, we looked at two options on the cyberstalking issue, and that was to do a civil action or a criminal action. And since we already had the civil action bill 965 going, and because of the constitutional issues that a criminal action raised, what we did is essentially amend the cyberstalking issue, that's your dash one and dash two amendments, onto Senate Bill 965, which we were already working on. So this is becoming a train, and obviously there might be other cabooses out there, but we're hoping this is the last one. So
I really appreciate that. And the constitutional issue you refer to, of course, is Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which has stronger free speech protections than the National First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And so for that reason, we often find ourselves in Oregon protecting speech and communications that most of us find quite repugnant. And this would be an example of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to excuse myself. I've got to go to another committee hearing, but District Attorney Josh Marquis has the particulars of our case, and I think he can add his very strong voice in support of this legislation.
I appreciate that, and he has signed up next.
Thank you.
He will be on. Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Marquis.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the district attorney in Clatsop County, where I have been for about 11 years. I'm here today at the request of Senator Johnson, Senator Brown. This case came to my attention about 6 months ago when it became clear that a man on the coast, a middle-aged man, had obtained a filter that you can get on the internet for about $80 or $90. It's theoretically supposed to be a night vision lens. It just screws on the end of a camcorder. He had taken this and he had gone to the local Astoria Aquatic Center where the high school teens have their meets. And he was photographing the bodies of the young women who were on the Astoria swim team. He was zooming in on particular parts of their body, personal parts of their body. He then made copies of this and provided at least one to a neighbor who was so horrified they contacted police. Police executed a search warrant on his house. He had already destroyed the original computer. He told us that he had not posted these on the internet. That was one of the greatest fears that the parents had. But here's the glitch. As Chairman Burdick says, the technology outpaces the law. When the tanning bed law was passed by you not that many years ago, it was because we if somebody was looking through a keyhole in a tanning bed or in a place where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy, like a dressing room, that would be a crime. Well, the key word there is expectation of privacy. The argument in this case was, well, these young women who are in a swimming pool don't have an expectation of privacy when they're in a public area, nor when they're at a beach. Now, common sense tells us that they have an expectation that someone's not going to look through their clothing, and Senator Johnson has provided you with what I think is an advertisement. These things abound on the internet. Originally, I thought the police were sort of overreacting until they brought me the tape, and it was very obvious what was going on. I met with a large group of parents from Astoria High School who were furious, wanting to know what I could do about it. I explained to them I was going to try to think of something, but I had a big problem because the current law, because of the expectation of privacy issue, probably would result in a judgment of acquittal. using some of that awesome power that district attorneys have to threaten more serious offenses, I was actually able to leverage a conviction out of this particular defendant. He did plead guilty to invasion of privacy. He is required to undergo mental health treatment. He did have to write letters of apology to every one of the students. But if I had gone to trial, I would have lost that case because the law simply doesn't cover it. So it's a very real-life example. I'm talking to prosecutors around the United States. I'm finding out that this is not commonplace, but it is beginning to happen. And it's something I think that every person says, well, I guess I can expect somebody's going to take a picture of me if I'm wearing a swimming suit, but not that they'll look through the swimming suit.
Right. I appreciate that. And you also signed up for the bill, for the criminal sanction bill, but I must say it's refreshing to see a district attorney look at other remedies as well, so I appreciate that very much.
I hope that my testimony would be basically the same for the other bill. I think Senators Brown and Johnson wanted you to have a very concrete example of the problems we've been having and why this kind of legislation is actually needed.
Maybe while you're at the table, I believe we have Ms. Barnes here now. Would you like to come up and testify? I don't want to put you on the spot, but were you expecting to testify?
Yes.
Okay. Please have a seat and tell us your story. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I'm Cecilia Barnes.
Okay, and could you just tell us what happened and why you're here supporting this bill?
Well, I'm here supporting the bill because I have an ex-boyfriend that has been stalking me online. As you all know, he posted pornographic pictures of me online under a number of different profiles, and is chatting online, pretending that he's me, which is, identity theft, and setting up dates for me, and I have guys showing up at my place of employment, getting emails, getting phone calls, things of that nature. I contacted the police. They said they were unable to help me because they didn't know how to deal with anything like this.
Right.
They couldn't see a crime. He wasn't contacting me specifically. He was going through third parties. So I got fed up with it and decided I was going to contact, the news media and see what I could, if I could get some help that way. And Pat Doris from KGW-TV has been very, very helpful. So he came out and interviewed me at my place of employment because that's where the biggest part of this has taken place with the guy showing up for their supposed dates with me and talked to me and my supervisor. And because of that, somehow or another, it got over to the DA's desk, which ended up at the Portland Police Department, and they have finally contacted me. But they don't know how to handle it. And there's no law against what's going on with him doing that here in the state of Oregon. So
we were discussing this before you got here. This is being a classic case where the law has failed to keep up with the technology, and because I think you've done a real service by being public about this. It might not have been the easiest thing for you to do to become public, but I think you've done a lot of good to share your story because it really elevated.
I hope so.
You certainly got our undivided attention. It was quite a powerful story, Mr. Doris. Is there more you wanted to say, or would you be willing to answer a couple questions if there are any? Okay,
I'm
thank
at
you.
Your disposal.
Are there questions from the committee?
I would just ask.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Barnes, it was truly a tragic story for you, and I think you still live it every day. Were you able to be successful with Yahoo to get them to shut down the sites?
Well, what happened is I contacted Yahoo. I have sent them a number of letters for the past 4 months, and because that's what they said to do. I went to their website and looked at, what their terms of service were and what it said to do if you thought someone was impersonating you, on their website. And they said to either phone them, email them, fax them, or write them letters. I tried phoning them, but never could get through. Couldn't leave a message because their message box was always full. Couldn't fax them because their fax machine was busy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I ended up having to write them a letter, sent them proof of who I was, and what screen name at that time was being used, because there's been like five different ones. And they would finally, within about 3 to 4 weeks, make that screen name unavailable. And then this person that was doing this to me, Randy Russell, he would just wait a day or so and then stick another one up underneath a different name.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Burns, I'm not sure how you're ever going to end this nightmare on Yahoo, because I'm sitting there thinking there must be a cause of action against Yahoo if you ask them to shut it down and they don't. But they shut it down and then he opens up a new screen name.
Yes.
That's tough. That's why we're considering this this bill, to have other sanctions, because this seems to have... Counselor, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Locke, to follow up on your comment, it is possible, and it would certainly get the attention of the ISP and other ISPs, to amend this bill to include a cause of action against an ISP that fails to respond to such requests in the circumstances that are outlined in the... what will be the Dash 1 amendment.
Madam Chair, Mr. O'Leary, I appreciate that, because that's what came to my mind as Ms. Burns was testifying, is there has to be some responsibility on the part of the Internet service provider here when you've been notified. It's much like a credit card company when you've notified them that this isn't your charge and or your credit card and they keep doing it and you have a cause of action. So there's got to be something else we can do, but I quite frankly don't know how we can stay one step ahead of this scumbag who keeps doing something like this.
Yes, it would seem to me that it would be very reasonable for the ISP in a case like this to just drop this particular person as a customer of the ISP. But
well, you know, that's what I was hoping for, you know. I mean, because that's what they said, you know, to do, you know, when you write them. They said, you know, that they take it very seriously, you know, and would, you know, basically do what needed to be done. But like I said, he was always one step ahead of them. And
but Madam Chair, Ms. Burns, he signs up with them. He has a name and a real name and a real address, and then he creates a screen name.
You don't have to do that with Yahoo.
Oh.
See, that's not required with Yahoo. That's required with AOL. That's required with MSN, all the other ones. But with Yahoo, you don't have to subscribe to them. If you've ever been to Yahoo at all and you look at the screen names and the websites and stuff that they have available on Yahoo, anything and everything is available, and I mean anything and everything is available on Yahoo.
Mm-hmm. Well, this manager and Ms. Barnes, this raises another area of the law that's deficient, I think, where we are not requiring people to register with a real name and a real address behind your screen name. That, I believe, is probably a congressional action, but it certainly is something that we could alert our Congress folks to, because this is really pretty frightening.
And, you know, and it might be that way, and this is where I feel, I don't know if it's right, that it's like that, because you don't have to pay for Yahoo. You have to pay for AOL, you know, but you don't have to pay for Yahoo. Yeah. So anybody has access.
Okay. Well, thank you again for coming. We really appreciate it. And we're going to close the public hearing at this time on this bill, which is 965. And we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 297. And that deals with the same subject area, but it has a criminal approach. And our counsel will give a summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Right now, it is under 163.700, there is an offense called invasion of personal privacy. It applies in some limited situations. This bill would redesignate that offense as invasion of personal privacy in the second degree and classify that as a Class A misdemeanor, and then create a another offense that would be a C felony, invasion of personal privacy in the first degree. the invasion of personal privacy in the first degree would be committed if the victim of the offense is less than 16 years old and if the defendant knowingly makes a visual recording and knowingly disseminates it, and the defendant has a prior conviction for invasion of personal privacy in any degree that at least was not part of the same criminal episode.
Okay, before we call our witnesses, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason this bill has come forward is was brought to my attention. Actually, I remember some of the cases of the incidents being provided through the local media in the Eugene-Springfield area. At the request of Dan Brazil, who's actually detective with the Eugene Police Department, he contacted me to see what, if anything, we could do at the state level to expand and modify the current privacy statutes. And so Kamala Sugar is here. She's with Lane County District Attorney's Office. I believe Josh Marquis is going to be giving testimony or not.
I think you've heard.
He's signed up. We'll welcome you up here, Josh, in case anybody has a question.
Kamala is was one of the assistant district attorneys who was involved with the case. Dan and I, we've known each other for years because of my work in the as a prosecutor. And he, after he shared it with me, I basically said, well, let's see what we can get drafted. Kamala has come up from Eugene today, and she's going to give you kind of the overview as to how this has actually come about to the point of where we are asking this committee to actually make some changes that will modify the existing crime and invasion of personal privacy and actually maybe address some of the issues that are, let's say, running contrary to what the technology is and what the laws currently are.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name for the record is Kamala Sugar, and I'm a deputy district attorney in Lane County. I'm also a member of the Oregon District Attorneys Association's Legislative Committee. On behalf of the committee and the District Attorneys Association, we support Senate Bill 297. I wanted to first mention that there is a bill in the House right now, in House Judiciary, which just passed out of the Subcommittee on Criminal Law with a -1 amendment, and it is bill, House Bill 2457. It also deals with invasion of personal privacy. Has some provisions regarding specific ages of the victims and has some provisions regarding enhancement to the crime, making it a felony. I would encourage committee counsel, and we've spoken about trying to get these bills to be at least consistent with one another, if not at some point combining them into a single bill that addresses the issue. On the -1 amendments for 2457, I understand that they have been amended to include things such as upskirting, which is a specific case I'm aware of out of Multnomah County involving a video camera being placed in a bag underneath a woman's skirt and taking photographs up the skirt. This again, kind of confronts the issue of what constitutes an expectation of privacy. Does that include one's undergarments and things like that? So it would be natural to include concerns about infrared cameras and that. With regard to the cases in Lane County that I'm here to talk about, the case that Senator Brzezinski mentioned involved a man who was videotaping and photographing teens and preteens, up to 150 different people. We were able to identify 30 of those girls. Some of them would not have qualified under the statute because they were prepubescent, and one of the major fixes that's necessary in the statute is to include prepubescent victims. Also, in that case, these were all Class A misdemeanors. And had the offender in that case not actually broken into some of the houses to set up the recording devices and take the pictures, it wouldn't have qualified him for the 14 years that he's currently serving on the burglary charges. But the invasions of personal privacy would have all resulted in just 1 year local jail at the maximum, and it would have been a real travesty given his long-time behavior of doing this. Finally, I spoke with Detective Brazil on my way here this afternoon, and
he asked me to mention that in his experience, he was surprised at how damaging just the fact that they were recorded in their homes was to these teens and preteens, that it was extremely upsetting and an extreme invasion of their privacy, and it had long-lasting effects on them as individual people. And I just wanted to mention that as well. I do support this bill. I support that in certain circumstances it should be a Class C felony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I just want to put on the record, Detective Brazil would have been here. In my understanding, he's involved as a witness in a significant felony case, was not able to get away, and so Kamala, who's actually, I'm not sure if this case you actually worked on, know that Karen Tracy, who's another assistant district attorney in Lane County, was involved in some of them. But I know that she, both of them have been involved. And so Kamala was willing to be available today. I think the other part about the upskirting, it's not only, I think, today we've got the modern technology of actually having these type of mini cameras, but also I think that we would want to look at something that's outside of electronics in the sense of just mirrors and stuff like that, where, again, where there's the expectation of privacy. And it may not be something that's captured for dissemination into a media, but at the same time, I think it is a violation of these individuals' rights.
Madam Chair, if I may make one additional comment.
Please.
That actually captures a case that I did handle with Detective Donica in the Eugene Police Department, which was a 7-year-old boy who walked into the bathrooms at Walmart. His mother stood outside waiting for him. And while he was using the facility, a camera was reached underneath from a stall, and a digital photograph was taken of him while he was exposed. He noticed that flash, was concerned, immediately went out to his mother, told her what happened. The security of the store surrounded the bathroom, waited for the man to exit. By the time he exited, the photograph had been deleted from the camera. And it was we were unable to show that it was any kind of dissemination or recording, even though it's very evident from what the little boy said that that's what happened. And again, that's a comment with regard to trying to keep up with technology. Clearly, it was used for purposes that were inappropriate. Thank you.
I don't think 5 years ago we even had the word upskirting mm-hmm. in our vocabulary. I wish we still didn't. Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask both these individuals, since with their background in the criminal prosecution, we heard from Ms. Barnes talking about how this individual has continued to cause her a lot of issues by what I call harassment. And it seems to me we talk about telephonic harassment, how we can actually protect someone from calling a person at a phone without having any really communicative purpose or for after they've been told to desist. I'm wondering if we should try to look at something within maybe our harassment statutes or something like that that might address where someone is disseminating false information about somebody onto the internet system and trying to get in touch with what is a reality today and how victims are being impacted through these electronic means.
Chair Burdick and Senator Pisanski, members of the committee, there's a bill that's one of Oregon District Attorney's Association's priority bills that amends the telephonic harassment statute to include text messaging, another example of our attempts to keep up with technology. And it might be just the right vehicle for something that is being suggested by Senator Pisanski. And that bill number is House Bill 2318. It currently has not yet had a hearing, and I know I have a call in to the chair of that committee to see if that can be set.
Do you know if it's in judiciary?
It is.
Okay.
It is in House Judiciary.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Did you have anything to add, Mr. Markey?
No. Kamala, I think, spoke about it. The one area that I'm a little concerned about...
Introduce yourself for the record one more time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Josh Markey, Clatsop County District Attorney. The one area that I'm still concerned about, and Senator Burdick, you raised this and talked about the Oregon Constitution, is that we may have to redefine expectation of privacy. At the moment, basically, obviously being in a bathroom stall, you would. In a canning booth, you would. but what is your expectation of privacy on the street? That's the UpScript bill deals with that. Well, you don't have an expectation of privacy that someone's not going to look at you, but obviously not look up your clothing. So I think one of the things we have to be careful about is not to write the bills too specifically, because the technology will always outpace us. But what we may want to do within the confines of the Oregon Constitution is define the critical language in a place and circumstances where the other person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. And this just occurred to me while I was sitting here. If that were to be interpreted as in a place or circumstances where the person had an expectation of privacy, then the place might be a place where they wouldn't, but the circumstances would. And that's the one area I'd urge you to focus on. I'm not a constitutional law scholar, so I don't know how that would get interpreted.
That's why we have Mr. O'Leary here.
Thank you. That's right. And I was actually the sponsor of the bill that eventually became law in 1997 on the expectation of privacy, and I remember how we struggled with it even then when the issue seemed a lot simpler. So I appreciate your coming. Thank you.
Thanks.
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hummel. John Hummel.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I want to begin by commending Senator Przanski for the balance that this bill reflects. OCDOA consistently advocates for criminal penalties that are proportionate to the criminal offense. This bill is a model for balancing the rights of victims, defendants, and justice. Should it be a crime to install a video camera to record someone in the nude? Of course. This bill recognizes that offense is a Class A misdemeanor. If someone actually records a child after having been previously convicted of a similar offense, should it be a crime with a heightened penalty? Of course. This bill recognizes such offense, an offense as a Class C felony. This bill respects a balance. This bill recognizes that different conduct deserves different penalties based on the particulars of the conduct. This is a bill our organization supports, and I just wanted to publicly thank the senator for the balance that he brought to this most challenging problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Hummel. Okay, we will. We still want to do a little work on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 297, and we will open a public. I'm going to do 1012 now. Mm-hmm. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1012. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1012 would extend the Planning and Advisory Committee relating to improving the health and well-being of children of parents involved in the criminal justice system. The committee now exists, and this bill would extend the committee's work to the 2005-2007 legislature.
Okay, we've got Claudia Black signed up on this, I believe. I'm winging this. There we go, and Cindy Duran. No, no, it's not your fault. Very good. Welcome, and I apologize again for not having time for this hearing before. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We appreciate being here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here today as the chair of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project and the executive director.
Closer to the mic.
And the executive director of the Children's Justice Alliance, which is a 501c3 whose mission is to improve outcomes for children whose parents are involved in the criminal justice system. And I'm speaking today in support of SB 1012 with the -1 amendments. I'm going to keep my comments brief. SB 1012 provides for the continuation, as committee staff said, of a planning and advisory committee to help improve outcomes for these children. Several weeks ago, you heard a presentation by Max Williams, the Director of Corrections, on the committee's accomplishments to date, as well as the recommendations for the last biennium. And as you heard from Max Williams' testimony, over 20,000 children in Oregon have a parent incarcerated in prison, and many thousands more have parents who are incarcerated in jail or are under supervision. And we know that these children are many times more likely to go to prison than are their peers. They're at very high risk. We also know that 41% of children in foster care have a parent or caregiver who is a convicted felon, and that 20% of inmates in Oregon were in foster care as children themselves, and that's very consistent with national data. And we believe because of the significant overlap between the systems who serve these families that it's critical to coordinate the activities. We include members from all aspects of the criminal justice and human services systems. The work group has provided a forum for research and policy discussion. Also, as you heard from Max Williams, the committee's efforts have produced significant results over the last several years. These include parent education classes in the prison and in Oregon Youth Authority, an early Head Start program at the women's prison, public awareness, development of recommendations for the public safety system, as well as for K-12 and child welfare. And we're currently working on a training curriculum for organizations who provide services to these families or are involved with them in some way. It's one of the big gaps that has been recognized. So this would be training for law enforcement officials, teachers, child welfare workers, corrections, and community corrections staff. We believe that the work of the committee is essential to helping to continue to improve outcomes for children whose parents are involved in the criminal justice system and to breaking the cycle, intergenerational cycle of criminality. I urge an aye vote on SB 1012 with the -1 amendments to continue the work of the committee. And with me is Cindy Duran, a member of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Work Group, who is formerly incarcerated, has five children. She's spoken to you before, and she's going to briefly comment on the committee's work on her life and those of her children. And I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Grant. If you could introduce yourself for the record, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Duran, and I am a recovering methamphetamine addict and also a former inmate at Coffee Creek. A few weeks ago, I testified on the impact of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, and so I'm here again today to support Senate Bill 1012 and to comment further on how the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project has affected not only my life but also my children. At the time of when I was sentenced, one of the remarks from the judge was that the best thing that could possibly happen to my children was that I'd never be allowed to see them again. At that point, I would have to completely agree. There was no programs available when I was in jail, in county jail. Once I got to Coffee Creek, I did have a baby in there, and although I didn't get to see him for 15 months, I am grateful for the fact that the CIP project had been able to put some programs into place, such as Early Head Start, in order for me to start bonding with my son. This is a very important time for him and for my other children. I was going to be there for almost 3 years, and I did the parenting classes, learned to communicate with my children, which has made the transition back into their lives easier on not only myself but also them. I have learned to how to parent my children, and also to change with the cognitive programs, how to change my way of thinking. So I just wanted to keep it brief, and again, I'm just here to support the Senate Bill 1012. Thank you for allowing me to testify again.
Thank you very much for coming and sharing your story again. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Starr.
Comment and a question, I guess. I'm aware that Justice Fellowship through Angel Tree Ministry has provided parents with the opportunity to give gifts to their children at Christmas time. Over 600,000 children nationwide received presents from their parents as a result of that ministry. I don't see them as players in this proposed legislation, unless it would be under J, page 2, line 1. Question.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I'd be happy to be in contact with them. If you have contact information, I think they'd be a welcome addition to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Starr. That was helpful. Are there any more questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, just a comment. I also don't see anywhere on that list a representation of the children or the people who the service is provided for. And sometimes a representation like that is worthwhile to really, for the committee to understand if the service is really addressing the issue.
Did you have a comment on that?
That actually, even though it's not reflected here, and maybe we should amend it to be sure that's covered, we probably have 5 or 6 members, both men and women, who were formerly incarcerated and have taken part in the programs. And we don't have any children that are represented on there, but Cindy's son has come to speak to the committee before. But I think it's a good idea to make sense to have an older child who's able to participate.
Thank you.
But there's nothing in this bill that would prohibit you from doing that.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Are there other questions? Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1012.
Madam Chair?
Welcome, Representative Boone.
Representative Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I just came up here to lend my support to this bill. This is a great program. Claudia has been doing a wonderful job. There's so few programs in our communities that start with combined treatment and prevention, and this is one of them, and this is innovative, and I just love to see them do more and more of this. And Cindy's a good success story. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you very much. Are there questions of Representative Boone? Thank you very much. And I apologize. I thought you were here on the next bill. So now we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1012. And I would be very receptive to move this unless I see negative reaction from somebody. Senator Starr, we have a -1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1012.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1012. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 1012 amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 1012 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Chair, I've always been a supporter of this program. I just can't say enough about it. It's great.
Okay.
So
that's wonderful. Any other discussion? So ordered. Who would like to carry this?
I would.
Senator Starr, thanks.
You want to carry it, Charles? Okay, I'll let you carry it.
Charles would like to carry that. I kind of thought he might. So, okay. Now we will open up a public hearing for somebody else who waited yesterday fruitlessly, and that is on Senate Bill 401. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 401 is a bill regarding a unitary assessment in criminal cases. The bill as written would create a unitary assessment specific to crimes where the victim of the crime was a child in the form of a fill-in-the-blank amount. There is a pretty extensive -2 amendment that instead of creating a new unitary assessment for convictions involving crimes against children, instead what would happen is that the current unitary assessments for felonies, misdemeanors, DUIIs, and violations respectively would be increased by $1. And then the additional part of the -2 is that it includes the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon as one of the recipients of the monies that are distributed as a result of that unitary assessment.
Senator Pazansky.
I just want to ask counsel, so if we, what I'm hearing is that we would just add them into the, let's call it the group or the pie of other recipients. And is there any specific division for each and every one of those groups, or is it just...
The way it would be written, Senator, is that the distributions would be made in the order. There's no. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Krasnowski.
All right.
What do you mean? That's my job.
Just means I'm so comfortable now. My reading of the bill is that there are no percentages written in, but that it would be distributed in the order of the following priority. First, public safety standards, trainings, and facilities. Second, criminal injuries, compensations, and assistance to victims. And then third, the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. And then fourth, emergency medical services and enhancement account.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have, let's see, where's our sign up here? Where's the sign up? Oops. There we go. We have Representative Boone, who signed up for this as well, and Mr. Kafori. I guess you wanted to testify together.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Please send my apologies to Cindy Thompson, who was here yesterday to testify on this. I regretted not being able to get to it.
I'd like to ask that Claudia, if she's on the board. Also.
Claudia is always welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Why don't you guys go ahead and I'll...
And I'm, again, for the record, State Representative Deborah Boonhouse, District 32, and I'm also a member of the board of the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. And I was placed on the board by an appointment by the governor, and then when I became a state representative, I had to step back and give my seat up, but they found another spot for me as just a regular board member, so now I'm not a governor appointee, I'm just a regular old board member. And this is just a tiny bit of history on this. This is coming full circle for me. Back in the late 70s, that's when I first had my first experience of citizen lobbying before the legislature to get a children's trust fund enacted as a checkoff on our state tax forms. And it took about two or three sessions, but we finally got it on and have been there ever since. And most recently was just appointed and then elected to the board. So this is a long time project for me, and being on this board has come full circle. And now this board has joined forces with the Children's Justice Alliance, which Claudia is also a principal, and we are doing some really great things. We are one of the premier primary prevention entities in the state and giving grants to programs that do primary prevention for children and to prevent child abuse. And finally, this is April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, so this is very appropriate for the bill to be heard during this month, and I appreciate the committee's attention to this. And I'm going to let Steve and Claudia talk about the specifics of the bill itself, because I'm not an attorney. So thank you very much for your attention and your consideration of this very important bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Did you want to say, Claudia? You want to raise your hand? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm a lobbyist for the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. I have some information. Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, your question about exactly how this would work. Brad Swank is here, who's the administrator of the program, can tell you the details of how the money is divided up. What I wanted to do today is to give you a very brief background on who we are and why we think we should be back in the Unitary Fund. The Children's Trust Fund of Oregon is a not-for-profit granting agency supporting 33 programs in 23 counties around the state to prevent child abuse and neglect. We focus on target audiences using local criteria. There are 24 of these 33 programs are in rural counties, so we can see our emphasis is out around the state. We assist these local programs with technical assistance in addition to providing grants, and we provide a detailed evaluation based on outcomes, not based on inputs. We are in turn evaluated by Portland State University, and they do this every year, and we'd be happy to get the evaluations if the committee is interested. They always think we're doing a good job. We presently receive money from workplace giving, like the United Way. We go in separately from the United Way. We get dollars from there. We have a birth certificate program that the state legislature established a number of years ago where you can get a fancy birth certificate signed by the governor. And that money goes to us. As you heard from Representative Boone were on the checkoff, which has gotten smaller every year because more and more people are getting on that checkoff list. And private donations. The Portland State report says that of every dollar that we grant to a local community program, over $4 is leveraged in additional funds. So this money that we give really is seed money for maintaining local programs around the state.
Senate Bill
936-1 puts the Children's Fund back into the Unitary Fund. A brief bit of history. We were established in 1985. Established by the legislature, given federal money at that point. There was a board of trustees established to manage the program and to solicit private monies. The state of Oregon, through the Department of Human Services, gave us our operating expenses. Through the Department of Human Services, they provide space and staff. In 1995, we were established as an independent state agency funded by a unitary fund. The state paid all of the operating costs of the program and also created an endowment fund, which was planned to be $5 million. In 1999, Senator Neil Bryant, I grabbed him yesterday and asked if he could testify, but he had to go back and was not here today. He would have been here yesterday when this budget didn't come up. He pushed a lot of bills, you may recall, privatizing a lot of smaller boards and commissions. Children's Trust Fund became one of those. The feeling was that as an independent nonprofit agency, it would have more flexibility than as a state agency. The statute that established us, that de-establishes as a state agency and establishes us as a nonprofit, said it guaranteed that state money would continue to come to us despite the fact that we're no longer a state agency. In 2001, a couple of good things happened. The $5 million was a total received and reached, so we had our trust fund full and could start giving money from the interest in the trust fund, which resulted in a 25% increase in grants to local communities. The advantage here was that we could go to private givers and say that all the money for operating expenses would come from the state and all of the money that they would give in private donations would go directly to program, so they wouldn't be paying for operations, and that's an incentive to get private money. It worked very well. The bad thing that happened in 2001 was that this legislature decided they wanted to shift us from the unitary fund to the general fund with a big promise that the money would remain intact. Well, as you all recall, after 2001, there were a number of special sessions. We, at that point, were stuck in the Department of Administrative Services, and one at a time through the special sessions, we got our money reduced until we were totally eliminated. There was nobody in the Department of Administrative Services that really cared about us as an agency, and when they had to make cuts, it was easy for them to just to cut us. What we're asking in this bill is to be returned to the Unitary Fund. The way it would work, and Brad Swank can tell you more details, is that we would add $1 to each fine, which would grant us somewhere in the neighborhood of $485,000 a biennium. This is less than half, or I guess approximately half, of what we used to receive back in the old days when we were part of the unitary fund. We were receiving $900,000 a biennium. But at this point, with the budget limitations, we're happy to get something, and that would be $485,000 would go a long ways, especially when you figure that that money is turned over by local communities by a number of times. We would hope that you would send this bill on to Ways and Means and give it your approval. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Claudia, you want to add anything?
Just a couple of brief comments. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm, for the purposes of this bill, I'm here representing the Children's Trust Fund as a board member. And I hadn't expected to testify today, but I'd like to add my support to Representative Boone and Stephen Kafori's comments. As Stephen said, the Children's Trust Fund helps support programs that prevent child abuse and neglect. And what we're finding is with the budget cuts in Department of Human Services, it has an even more critical role than it has in the past. And sometimes the amount of seed money that the Children's Trust Fund can provide to a community really makes the difference between that community being able to have a program or not, because it helps leverage funds from other programs that are involved. So I'd just like to say that I very much support SB 401. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. We will close the hearing. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We almost did that again. I did that last time. We have Brad Swank and Sybil Hebb signed up. Welcome to the committee. It wasn't intentional to forget you on that last bill, but we will have it back again, so I'll pick you up.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'm here speaking primarily on the Dash 2 amendments, which will probably, well, I'm sure that they were drafted at our encouragement. One of the things that I get to do as part of my duties over here is I get to go around and pick up bills that deal with the unitary assessment and encourage people to draft them so that they work with the unitary assessment revenue stream and process as we designed it in the 90s. And we did that with Ways and Means because it eliminated a lot of workload and allowed us to implement these changes and assessments more quickly, more easily, and to create a more dependable, predictable revenue stream for the legislature. And that's what's happened with the unitary assessment process. And the way it works is, we can tell the legislature how much money it creates, and we're fairly accurate at this, if they adjust the unitary assessment up or down. That's barring, I mean, if you lay off a bunch of police, that would change, or if something like that happens. But all other things being equal, we can tell you what a $1, $2, $3 increase will create in revenue. We've been pretty accurate. They raise that at the front end, and then at the back end, the legislature appropriates the monies to those programs that they think are appropriate to be in that stream. And it's been set up in such a way that we can implement it reasonably quickly, without training, without changes to our accounting systems. And when I started, before the unitary assessment, there were 20-some different assessments. There were some offenses that had an assessment for this, an assessment for that, and the clerks were trying to figure out how many different assessments applied to each offense when it was created, or when somebody was convicted. It was an accounting nightmare. And we've eliminated all that into a single, why it's called a unitary assessment, is because originally all of the people that got money out of this revenue stream were brought into the unitary assessment revenue stream and given a percentage. And the legislature since then has changed those percentages and has taken some people out. But the system works relatively well, and the Dash 2 amendments are the amendments that we encouraged them to move towards because we could predict how much money. And I'm here to answer any other questions you've got about unitary assessment. Other than wanting the system to be easy to manage and to be predictable, we have no interest particularly in who gets the money. That's the legislature's policy decision.
Thank you very much for the questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pozanski.
Brad, I wonder if you could just put on the record how this would work under the Dash 2s, looking at line 18 and going down and showing the priorities, the first one being the public safety standards, training, and facilities. Then going into B, it looks like we would have three different group or entity combinations that would be at the same level as the way I'm reading it. And then the last one would be the emergency medical services.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pozanski, three sessions ago the legislature changed from giving people a percentage to sort of setting a philosophy for the criminal fines and assessments revenue stream. And what happens is the money goes from us and from municipal and justice courts into this stream, some the unitary assessment money, and it goes into the criminal fines and assessments account where it's split. And it's split, and the legislature decides the split every session. And some of it goes to the general fund, and some of it goes to this account that you see here, the Criminal Fine and Assessment Public Safety Fund. And what you see in ORS 137-302 is the philosophy of that fund. They are not specific appropriations. The agencies still, as they used to have to do when they got percentages, they have to go to Ways and Means and they have to say, we need this much money, and the legislature makes an appropriation. They used to make another funds limitation for the agency when they had a percentage. Now they make an appropriation, and they can pick among any agencies that they want that do public safety standards, training facilities. A lot of this money goes to the police academy, or they give a lot of money to victims and to local victims programs and district attorney's offices. But they make the decision in ways and means, encouraged by the rest of you, I'm sure, about which programs are going to get the money out of this fund. 137.302 just states the philosophy. So by adding themselves in, the Children's Trust Fund has made sure that they're part of the overall picture of who should be getting money. Ways and Means will still make the decision.
Thank you. Follow. Thank
you. But looking at line 20 versus line 21 versus line 24, is there a distinction through the Ways and Means process as to saying that public safety standards, training, and facilities have top priority? Does that have anything to do with the percentage that's given to that level as compared to the grouping that's in line 21 and line 22, 23?
Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, from my experience, most of the money that's in this fund goes to pay for the police academy there. I think they're almost entirely funded out of this, and they're the number one priority. And the others get money that's left over, so they do give the biggest chunk, and that's why they put them first and in the first priority. Mm-hmm. My experience is that the other, traditionally what happens is the other people who want money out of it lobby for an increase in the unitary assessment amount of $1, $2, $3, or $4, and that money goes in, and then it Ways and Means, they say, we're bringing you $450,000 or $1 million or whatever, so we would like to take out this much at the back end.
One other question.
Senator Przanski.
And this money, or this, not money, this fund, the criminal fine and assessment public safety fund, is different from the CAMI money.
The CAMI money.
Yeah, the court assessment and monetary something.
I think the child abuse teams get money out of the back end of this from this criminal fine and assessment. I think that's some of their money gets appropriated to that. My understanding is that the money currently is being from the criminal fines assessment and public safety fund currently goes to the police academy. There is some money in there for the state police that they get for, they used to get for operating the crime lab. There's money for victims of crimes and the programs that the attorney general runs and some of the programs that the district attorneys run get money out of there. There's money for victims of domestic abuse. There's money for victims of child abuse. Mm-hmm. And there's money for some rural medical accounts and a poisoning, some money for the poisoning account in Portland. And that's, I believe, the list of people who currently, I could be wrong because I'm just sort of going from memory, and but that's who I believe gets the money.
But that's a separate fund. Or is that part of this fund?
I think that separate fund gets money from this fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, because I don't see all those things listed under here, so now I'm confused.
Well, Chair Burdick, they don't list them individually. In the appropriations bill at the end of session, what they do is they say, out of this fund, we're going to appropriate to this entity, so it becomes part of the big appropriations bill at the end of session, that they appropriate monies from the criminal fine and assessment public safety fund to the various projects that they've decided are going to be funded this session from this revenue stream.
So even though it lists all these things, that they're not bound to stick just to this list. That's what you're saying.
Sure. I'm not willing to speculate on what the Ways and Means Committee is bound by and not bound by. Normally, that's what they've done.
Madam Chair, I think what Ms. Swank is saying is that when you look on lines 21 and 22, where it says assist victims of crimes, and then it says and children recently suspected of victims of crime, that all of these other components make up that grouping of that's in there. My concern is I know that there's a lot of existing agencies that their budgets do in fact depend on these funds, and so what we're looking at is adding another component to that. I know that we're adding another dollar on each of them. The question, I guess, for Ways and Means is how much money is that bringing in, and how does that divvy up in the pot for the ability to take care of these other issues. And then when you look at the on the public safety standard training and facilities, you know, we've got a debt service on the new facility and all like that. So it's one of those things that maybe we don't get to have to worry about, since it goes down to the number of people in the dungeon. But, you know, there is definitely a lot of demand already existing on this this fund.
And so it's commendable that they chose to go up the hill with an additional assessment as well as just asking for the money.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And our interest in this issue stems from the fact that domestic violence and sexual assault victims services programs receive money from this dedicated public safety account, and they are one of the line items in the listing set out in lines 21 and 22 of the current statute. And the concern that we just wanted to bring to this committee is that there's a policy decision to be made here about whether that fund should be extended from currently simply providing services for, in at least in priority level 2 in section B on lines 21 and 22, criminal injuries compensation and services to victims of crime, whether they are adults or children. Right now the fund is listed specifically, it's dedicated specifically to services for people who have been victims, and expanding it to include the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon expands it to include prevention services. Clearly, prevention services are a great public service, and we want to make it very clear that we think the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon is just a great agency, and we're glad that it's present and working in our communities. But we're concerned about the impact of adding, or the policy decision that, or the impact of the policy decision of including preventative organizations, or this one preventative organization, in this line item of funding. And we, as I understand it, the legislature made a decision to remove the Children's Trust Fund in 2001 and to limit this particular fund for the provision of services to victims of crime. And if there's a decision that's made to expand that funding source, I just want to make sure that the committee is aware of what the implications are and what the impact will be on the other people in that fund, or the other organizations and services in that fund. I wanted to just echo Senator Pruszynski's comment that right now those agencies are struggling with the potential impact of the or the great impact of the increased debt service costs that will be as a result of the DPSST facility. And so those agencies are currently struggling or looking at a great negative a great reduction in funding right now, and are a little bit worried about adding another group. We do agree that it's very commendable, and we really appreciate that the bill right now adds money to the overall CFAA, which is Criminal Fines and Assessment Fund, but there's no guarantee that those extra funds come with the Children's Trust Fund into the dedicated public safety account. And so if there were a way to ensure that that extra money came into the dedicated fund, that would greatly alleviate some of our concerns. And just wanted to express that. So thank you.
Okay, maybe we could, and that's a point I'd like to explore. Maybe we could bring Mr. Kafoury back. And again, this is getting beyond our area of expertise because we're the policy committee, not the Ways and Means. But what assurances can you give on where the funding goes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Stephen Kafoury, representing the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. This is getting more technical above my head, and this is why I asked Mr. Schwenk when we introduced the bill. We talked to him originally, and we had a plan at that point to add specific penalties for specific crimes that impacted negatively on children, pornography, giving kids alcohol to minors, those kind of things, child abuse, criminal child abuse, and taking that money and giving it to the Children's Trust Fund so there would be a clear nexus between the offense and where the money went. Mr. Schwenk said that's really a bad idea. It doesn't work well administratively, and the best thing to do would be to go and add a dollar on and then take the money that comes from that a dollar. It was our intent not to have any impact on any other organization. We've experienced that same thing with the tax checkoff, where there's a limited amount of money. Essentially, potentially everybody could do a lot of tax checkoffs, but in reality people don't do income tax checkoff. The same number do every year, and as more and more organizations get it added to that, that pie, each piece gets smaller, and our piece has gotten quite smaller. We understand that process, and we don't want to be part of that process. So we are committed to a process, and if we need to amend this bill to make that happen, we'd be happy to do that, to make sure that the only money that we receive is the additional money that, that the bill asks for. And I'm not going to go to Ways and Means and say, well, you're going to be raising $450,000, but we want $600,000. Or if there's a cut, if the money doesn't come in, people are really good this next biennium and don't commit as many fines. Don't make many crimes and don't get so many fines, and the level goes down, total resources, we wouldn't say, well, we still want our $450,000. We'd be willing to take a proportional cut. We do not want to change the status quo, Madam Chair.
Well, and so you'd be receptive to an amendment that, that specified that you would stay within the revenue generated by that extra dollar.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Pazansky? I assume that he's going to, Mr. Kapoor is going to say yes, but it's much bigger than just that, because we don't know. I mean, Mr. Swank may be able to give us the dollar amount of how much is anticipated or expected based on the 2004 assessments that were made, how much it would come in. But the reality is what Ms. Sybil Hill has said, when the bottom line is there's a lot of agencies now that are already scrambling. They've already gotten notice that they may be looking at anywhere from 10 to 25% cuts out of this fund, and knowing that what's going to happen with DPSST's new building, you know, it could be for naught. I mean, every dollar that comes in here that's new could all go to just debt servicing and taking care of the public safety, and then we've got another agency that's very commendable that's in this mix fighting for whatever else is left over, if anything's left over. That's the issue here, and it's one of those things that I want to see them there, but we went through this, unfortunately, I think it was 1999 session where we did the significant, basically cut across the board, and just took all of these agencies that were part of this, depending on these, this type of funding, where they had different percentages in there, and now they're all in this kind of a fight for the general dollar that's left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things that, I want to do everything I can to make sure certain that this program can get some funding, because it does wonderful work, but at the same time, when we already have all these others that are already there that are in existence as well, doing work that in many of these in child areas, advocacy groups, Northwest Cares, throughout the state, that provide these child advocacy services for children that are raped, sexually violent, physically abused, that they're not going to find themselves at even more competition. I mean, that's the part about not having the revenue. I guess I'd like to have a little bit more information as to how much is going to be dedicated or coming in. It'd be nice that we could actually, if we're going to do some policy stuff, why don't we put some limits on how much goes to DPSST as compared to that goes to the other programs. They're all worthy programs, and when they're at the basically the second line of feeding, with the DPSST issues going first, there's no guarantees that any of these programs are going to be able to exist as they are today, let alone expand it to other services.
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, you guessed a little bit wrong my answer. What I wanted to say was that would be my intent, but in terms of technically how we make that work, I would hand that over to somebody who knows how that process works. I would remind the committee that we are not just another good organization out there coming in asking to feed at the public trough. We were established by the state legislature every state agency, and we were at the time we were taken off from being a state agency and set up as an independent agency, independent nonprofit corporation. The state legislature, in statute, said that the money that we get will be continued to be here. When we were taken from the Unitary Fund and put in the general fund, the promise was made by the governor's office and by the legislature, money will be there. Now I understand that things happen and financial situations change, but we haven't seen a 25% reduction in our money from the state. We've seen a 100% reduction of our money from the state. And all we're asking to do is to get back into where we belong. We're not just another organization coming to begin.
Madam Chair, And I'm not saying that, Stephen. I mean, this is a very worthy program, but as you know, the kennelization that went through in I think it was 1999, where all these programs were cut and how we've gone through this, I think if we're going to open this up to bring in any other organizations, I really would like to have a discussion on the policy of what the percentages should be. Because I want to make certain those programs that are providing these services, including the Children's Trust Fund, are going to be able to operate at a level that's going to provide services throughout Oregon and not be at a point of where everything is potentially going to public safety standards, training, and facilities, and we find little to none at the next levels.
Sure.
Senator, well, do you want to have him comment and then you...
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, as originally structured, what the CFAA fund did was it had specific percentages in the statute, and all the agencies were listed, so that and the change of the percentages went to the substantive committee first, and every session they came to us and they said when the new amount came in, the new agency or entity that was getting money out of the revenue stream, the percentage was adjusted because 100% of our monies goes in this, and that was the process that was eliminated in 1999 when the decision was made by the legislature that Ways and Means would make the decision about how this money was appropriated. So that was the original process that Senator Pruszynski was speaking about as well. Used to happen.
Okay, thank you. Senator Byer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I got a couple of, start with a comment to Mr. Rafori. The legislatures in the past may, and the governor may, good and well intended to say the money will always be there, but reality is, and most of us were probably here in those legislatures, but we cannot say what the legislature 2 years from now is going to do. That's, everyone knows, is unconstitutional. We cannot bind a future legislature. The other question, I think, is a bigger question. And when does a fine become a tax? And when do you draw that line? And I think that line has been blurred and grayed greatly in the last few sessions, and I think it gets more blurred by this. A fee or a fine is not a tax if it's used directly to a specific program that has something to do with that fee or that fine. It becomes a tax when it becomes used for other services or general services. When does a fine become a tax? And if it's a tax, how come it's in the Senate? It's a bigger question. As you start to open this door as to what gets in, it's then raising revenue. It's no longer just a fee or a fine.
And Senator Burdick, Senator Byer, the question you raised is an interesting one, which is why when we originally had the bill drafted, we wanted to make a connection between the particular fine for a particular offense. So that if a person were involved in child pornography or involved in abusing children, that fine they pay would go into a fund that helps prevent other people from doing that, so there would be a nexus. It seemed like a good idea to us at the time. Mr. Schwenk persuaded us that the other organizations have tried this process, and it really, for a number of reasons, doesn't work administratively. It's very costly for them. It's burdensome. So we were persuaded against that. That would be my preference, because I don't want to get into this game of is it a tax or not. But as you know, Senator, you get what you can get in the legislature. Politics is practicality, and if we brought in a bill that sounded good and made good sense and philosophically fit together, but it wasn't going to pass because administratively it was going to cost the state of Oregon $80,000 to administer, then we were no further ahead in the game. So we stepped back from our philosophy and went to pragmatic practice, and that's what we have here is an exercise in pragmatism.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. And the bill is drafted, it's fairly clear. There's a nexus between the crime and what the money is being used for. But when you start applying this logic to all crimes and then adding new things where it's going to be used for, it becomes a tax. And this amendment becomes a tax-raising revenue or a revenue-raising measure that has to be in the House, not in the Senate.
Chair Burdick, if I can.
Mrs. Swank, help us through this here as a non-Ways and Means.
As I said, when I first started with the courts some 19 years ago, that was the practice. all of the special assessments, people were tying, making a nexus to a specific crime. And it was an accounting and administrative nightmare. And not only was it very expensive for us to administer, because we had 20-some, and on each time somebody was convicted, you had to try and figure out which assessments applied and which didn't. And we got to do this in 36 court locations, and we had to modify the accounting system after every session, because every session there were new assessments coming in, and then we had to do training, which took us 6 to 9 months to train all the accountants in the 36 different court locations. So people weren't getting, aside from the fact that it was expensive, people weren't getting the money, and every time a new assessment came in, it affected the revenue stream for everybody else. So what we did was we moved 100% of that, 100% of that money into this revenue stream in a way that could be efficiently administered, so people actually got the money and it could be tracked, it could be accounted for, people can look for it, and we have traditionally opposed going back to a system that has been that is more expensive and difficult to administer, that makes for more complex government and doesn't guarantee people what they wanted. I mean, it's not something I'm sure we could do right now if we started down that road again.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up, I can appreciate what you're saying, and I'm not saying I want to go back to the old system. I'm saying that, in my opinion, as drafted, this amendment is running pretty close to a gray area between what becomes a tax and what becomes a fee or something like that, because this amendment is opposed to all, you know, anyone who has to pay these things, whether there's a nexus to the program or not. So, you know, you're right. I don't disagree. Ways and Means should make those decisions. If we want to give them guidance as a policy decision, reality is, this statute, when it gets to Ways and Means could say, notwithstanding ORS 137-302, all the monies in this account are going in the general fund. They'll go through and passes, and the DPSST and any of these people get nothing. I mean, that's reality, but the question, my issue is that this amendment, I believe, are taxes, not fees, because there is no nexus to the crime.
Yeah, I think that's something we might want to explore. At least some of the fees. Senator Pruzanski and I were just putting our heads together, and I was telling him that the Citizens Crime Commission in Portland would tell you that child abuse is one of the most potent predisposing factors for crime. So you could make a nexus there. Speeding tickets, you know.
Like I said.
If so, I was a very abused child.
It's one of those things that's pretty frustrating when you're, I mean, I don't know how it is for a defense attorney, but as a prosecutor, when you're in court and you've got a violation being assessed, the penalties, and the judge tells the person that you're getting an assessment, a unified assessment of $37, and they look at them and say, what's that? And I basically look at them and tell them, it's a tax on crime, and this is basically what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, we're trying to consolidate it, make it easier for the courts to be able to administer, et cetera, et cetera. But you get to that point of where those nexus aren't as close as if they are there at all. Because, I mean, it goes to great programs, but I don't know of all these programs. I guess you could say of that $37 for violations, maybe it goes to the police standards and training for training the officers who enforce violations.
You start a bill in the House and it passes now with 3/5. It used to not have that requirement. It doesn't matter what you use the money for.
Right.
Okay. I think this is worth looking into the legal interpretation of this. So thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 401. And, Committee, I haven't talked to you about this Senate Bill 246, but just for the heck of it, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 246, which is a bill that's gone through evolution, and I will let counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 246 was heard in a public hearing on the 8th of March, and as originally drafted, it would amend the statute that currently requires veterinarians to report aggravated animal abuse, as that term is defined in Chapter 167.322. At the direction of members of this committee, I directed Legislative Council to prepare the Dash 4 Amendment, which is before you now. And the Dash 4 Amendment essentially replaces the entirety of the original bill. What the Dash 4 does, in layperson's terms, is create a permissive reporting of animal abuse, garden variety animal abuse as opposed to aggravated animal abuse, on any person who learns of the animal abuse based on a disclosure from a child. Again, it is a permissive reporting statute, not a mandatory reporting statute, and it would insulate the reporter from any criminal or civil liability if the report was made in good faith.
Counsel, I have a question. Is this the Dash 3 Amendment? I see a Dash 3 Amendment.
The Dash 3 Amendment can be discarded, Madam Chair. The Dash 4 is the one that we are looking at.
Thank you very much. Okay.
And I should add that the change from the Dash 3 to the Dash 4 came yesterday at the request of the Veterinarians Association, and it was a very well caught glitch. It was, if you're looking at the Dash 4, it's in line 17. Mm-hmm. And the way that LC crafted this, section 1, paragraph 1 describes the veterinarian's duty to report aggravated animal abuse. Then the new section, the section that was crafted as a result of the committee request, is section 2. Section 1, subsection 2, which is the any person based on conversation with a child who has reasonable cause to believe that animal abuse has occurred, whether it be animal abuse or aggravated animal abuse, may report, not required, but may report. And then subsection 3 is the section that talks about how you make the report, and the word required was left in that paragraph and is now deleted. The concern was that if we left the word required in that paragraph of how you make the report, that it could possibly be inferred that veterinarians would be required to report both aggravated animal abuse and any other lesser degree of animal abuse. And that was not the intent of the amendment request. And now I believe that the Dash 4 amendment very adequately conveys that intent and makes clear that the veterinarian's duty to report aggravated animal abuse is unchanged, and the that there is no duty to report other sorts of animal abuse.
But this would provide protection to any person, regardless of whether they're a mandatory reporter?
That's right.
I understand it. Okay, because certainly the intent of this whole deal was the fact that sometimes children are able to talk about the abuse of the family pet when they're not able to talk about their own abuse. And if they're if the person hearing about the abuse of the family dog reports, then that might have some value to a law enforcement agency or a social service agency. I had intended it to be mandatory reporters who could add this, but this provides the immunity without the responsibility. Senator President.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to go over with counsel. What I understand is now this bill, if it was passed, would basically say anyone that came knowledgeable through a child's conversation that they may be some type of animal abuse occurring, that they could report it to law enforcement with the insulation of not being held liable because in good faith they're making this
Correct.
Report, and so no one has the duty to do it, but if they do take that exercise, that right or option, they would be insulated from any type of retribution from whoever might be investigated by law enforcement regarding animal abuse.
Correct. So the immunity without the penalty.
Madam Chair, if I could add to, and I think Senator Przanski is exactly right, and I should add that in researching this request, I did review statutes from Louisiana, Nebraska, Tennessee, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, California, the District of Columbia, Colorado, Ohio, and South Carolina. And in those states, the posture in which the concern about this permissive animal abuse came up. The question was sometimes raised, well, what's to prevent someone from reporting it anyway? It's no big deal. Why do we have to put a statute together? And some of the articles that I read about the context in which this came up in other states was that the concern was that there may be privacy issues or civil causes of action, slander, libel, et cetera, that a teacher or a children's services worker might be a little bit concerned if there was not this assurance that there would be no civil or criminal penalty for their report in good faith.
Okay. All right. We're in work session, and we might as well just try this and see how it goes. Senator Starr, have you had a chance to look at the dashboard? Senator Whitsitt, did you have a comment?
Yeah, a little bit of a problem with that in that I don't see where the where the rights of the accused
speak
are.
Speak a little louder.
I don't see where the rights of the accused here are protected at all. I mean, here we have a situation where the person who's making the claim is immunized against any retribution, consequences of making the report. They can make the report pretty much willy-nilly, and there is no indication that I can see in here that there's any way that the person who's falsely accused can get back at them.
Well, in the actual mandatory reporting statute, that's the same issue, and in this
it's aggravated animal assault.
This is
a difference, Chair Berger. I'm sorry, but the difference is in the original, the one that's being amended, we're talking about aggravated animal assault or whatever, and abuse. And this is very egregious. I mean, animal's been tortured, it's been broken up, it's been, you know. Here, you could say that someone swatted the horse too hard. And you know, you could do this repeatedly if you said that your child told you that. And no one could, and you would have no, the person who is being falsely accused would have no ability to come back on that.
Well, but if you didn't actually get this from a conversation with a child, you wouldn't meet the threshold for immunity in this. And this is not a criminal statute, you know, in the reporting aspect. Counsel, did you want to?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Whitsitt, I guess the only thing I would say is that the protection that the person about whom the report is being made has is that under Section 3, the grant of immunity by the person who is making the report only extends to reports that are made in good faith and for which there are reasonable grounds for making it. So I would say that that is the extent of the protection.
Is that extension, is that protection adequate?
Protection for the rights of, because nobody's actually been accused here yet. It's a report, not an accusation. So.
I, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if asked my opinion, I personally and professionally, I probably think that is, if this were a situation where we were creating a criminal offense as part of this statute, I may have a different opinion about that.
Thank you.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Senator Whitsitt. I think it even goes one further. I mean, if the way I'm reading this, if a child at school is having a conversation that on a windy, rainy night, their dog was sleeping out in the rain, and a teacher overheard it and had a vendetta or had a certain political meaning one way or another toward animals, they could conceivably go report that person. That person would be subject to some sort of investigation from law enforcement based on a report that their dog was sleeping in the rain.
Counsel?
I'm just, if you'll give me a moment, I'm looking up the legal definitions that are appropriate here. I'm not sure that, I think what Senator Byers is describing might be construed at best to be neglect, or maybe I mean at worst to be neglect. But if you'll just give me a moment, I'm looking up the definition of animal abuse.
Yeah, maybe this doesn't get there, and maybe it needs either us to give up or to try to, what we're trying to get at here, Senator Beyer, is cases where a child makes a statement about an animal that would cause alarm and that may actually reflect the treatment of the child themselves. I got the idea from a National Association of Prosecutors who specialize in child abuse issues, who had a two-part series in their newsletter on how oftentimes a child is able to tell a teacher or someone else about the abuse of the animal when in fact the child is being abused. And so the abuse of the animal is actually kind of a warning sign that there may be abuse of the child. Council.
Thank you. I have your answer, Senator Beyer. The cross-reference statute 167.315, animal abuse in the second degree, it requires physical injury to the animal, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And then 167.320, animal abuse in the first degree, again requires serious physical injury. That is a higher degree of physical injury to an animal or cruelly causing the death of an animal. And then aggravated animal abuse in the first degree, 167.322, which Senator Whitsitt has already referenced, is maliciously killing or intentionally torturing. And there are a variety of exceptions for all kinds of things like lawful hunting and keeping of livestock and things like that. So I guess to the specific example that you cited, it would probably not be applicable.
And this, you know, there's nothing in here that triggers any investigation of the animal abuse. It's just a report as far as this statute goes. It's just, you know, if the teacher calls and says, you know, little Johnny said, you know, his dad killed his dog last night, that teacher will have immunity.
I'm not sure I want the teacher to have immunity.
Okay. All right. I think I'm going to go ahead and close the list. You guys, I have really tried. I have tried so hard on this. The council has tried so hard on this. I don't know if this will be back or not. Okay. Now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 977. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 977 comes to us from AFSCME. And this bill would require local sheriffs, when transferring a defendant to the Department of Corrections, to provide the Department of Corrections with criminal, medical, and psychological records concerning the defendant. There would be a similar requirement on the supervisory authority or the local sheriff who is transferring a youth to the Oregon Youth Authority. Right now, the statute that's at issue 1-7, 320 only requires local sheriffs to deliver the defendant a copy of the judgment and a statement of the number of days the defendant was in custody prior to their delivery to DOC.
Thank you. We have Don Loving, and I just realized we're just about out of time, if not actually out of time, so if you can be brief, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. I can be quick, Madam Chair. Don Loving, I'm the Public Affairs Director for AFSCME. As such, I have worked with Mary Botkin for 19 years and Ralph Groener for 15 years. I always bring that up just because it helps make me a sympathetic figure.
Sympathy extended.
This bill comes to you through us, through our corrections counselors that work at the Oregon Intake Center, which is part of Coffee Creek Correctional Institution in Wilsonville. I realize Coffee Creek is thought of as the women's prison, and it is, but the Intake Center is also there, as where all criminals who enter the state prison system are processed, and then if they're female, they stay at Coffee Creek. If they're male, they're then assigned to other state prisons. Line 8 specifically mentions criminal, medical, and psychological records. I can actually tell you that our folks are mostly concerned about the medical and psychological records. And simply what happens is, in an effort to clear out the county jails, the sheriffs will often, you know, move the people without their records. And it does two things. It'll either create a backlog at the intake center for our folks to deal with, or in some cases when the backlog becomes too much, they will have to move the criminals into the prison system minus these records, meaning it causes a safety hazard for our corrections officers if the if it's 5 to 7 days later when the meds record and the psychological records come with the person. And we've had numerous cases of assaults or acting outs and such, which could be avoided, frankly, if the records simply moved with the person. And so this bill would require the sheriffs to move the records with the people. There's certainly no fiscal for the state, and there really shouldn't be for the sheriffs. It's paperwork they do anyway. This will require them to do it at the same time. And that's really all I need to say on this bill.
Okay. Now, what did you mean by criminal records?
I'm sure, I'm sorry.
What did you mean by criminal records?
Well, there are criminal, medical, and psychological records that move with each inmate. And I was just, you know, saying that in all honesty, it's more of a, if they're in the prison system, our folks aren't nearly as concerned about what their criminal record was. It's the medical and psychological records that they need to make sure their safety issues are taken care of. We need those to move with the person at the same time, not come 5 to 7 days sometimes behind the inmate.
Stand by. We'll call Mr. Powell up here, and we can just... Sorry, we lost track of time a little bit here, John. Welcome.
Let me get right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Where'd you come from?
The first floor, up the stairs.
You should be in the pedometer contest.
Yeah, well, there's a marathon going on down there with Senate Business and Commerce. I think they're meet all day, all night. Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 977 raises some concerns for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. My name is John Powell, representing that association. Our concerns deal with where, in particular, psychological records may be stored. As you can imagine, those records are confidential, and in most cases, the records do accompany an inmate when they are transferred. Some transfers can occur on weekends, and sheriffs are not fully staffed. So there are a lot of situations, individual situations, where it would likely be necessary then for the sheriff to keep custody of a certain inmate over a certain period of time. We do not believe this should be a legislative issue, and if it is a problem, the Department of Corrections and AFSCME and the sheriffs should sit down and try to resolve it informally, as opposed to pass a bill mandating that these records be transferred at exactly the same time. It is, I think, the practice in most jurisdictions that medical records and all the records be transferred at the same time. It makes sense from the sheriff's standpoint as well. There are other cases where you may have high-profile prisoners where security is at a height, and there may be situations like that where records would either be sent before or after. So, Madam Chair, we just, in summary, believe that this is not an issue for legislation at this time.
Thank you. Would you be willing to maybe sit down and have a little confab, and if we ended up needing something, or if there was a feeling that we needed something in the statute, that it would be something that would be flexible enough?
Madam
or
Chair,
ideally, I mean, it's always best to do things without legislation when you can.
Madam Chair, we'd definitely sit down and talk to them.
Okay. Appreciate from hearing back from all
okay.
parties
Thank
soon.
You.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing. Anybody have any questions? Okay. We will close the public hearing on 977. We will move Senate Bill 641 to next Wednesday. And we will move Senate Bill 273 to next Monday.
If you want Bill Taylor to do it. Yeah.
Next Wednesday. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Jenny, yes, can we hear 273 on Wednesday?